Investors Chronicle.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the IC Companies and Markets Show, coming to you from the depths of the FT building as usual. It's Thursday, the 7th of March, as we record, the day after Budget Day. We'll discuss the fallout from that event shortly and give some thoughts on the controversial UK ISA as well. We're also still in the thick of results season, so we'll be discussing one of the most popular domestic shares among private investors, and therefore you'd assume a prime candidate for a UK ISA, that's Legal & General. We'll also look at a business that likely won't feature because it's now set to be taken over by a US rival, that's Spirent Communications. And last but not least, our cover story this week is on dividends and why they matter. The UK market, of course, well known for its dividend payers, but they do sometimes get a bad rep in capital allocation terms. Our feature puts forward the case for the defence. We will come to that, but first of all, to introduce today's participants over the line, Mark Robinson. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Dan.
Julian Hoffman as well. Hi, Julian.
Hello there, Dan.
And in the studio, Hermione Taylor.
Hello.
And Alex Newman.
Hi, Dan. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you, everyone. We're going to begin with the budget, 24 hours on, as we record, as I say. Hermione, after a lot of build-up as usual, perhaps there wasn't quite so much going on with this one as there was in the autumn statement, or rather it seemed to be a repetition in some ways of what we saw in the autumn statement. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, this one seemed very restrained. So we had 110 measures introduced in the autumn statement, and there was a relatively modest 40 this time. There was a lot of speculation about exciting things, about inheritance tax and income tax. But in the end, on the giveaway side, we saw another 2p cut to national insurance. We saw a fuel and alcohol duty freeze, an extension of full expensing, and some changes to get rid of the child benefit cliff edge. And this is going to be partly paid for by some reforms to non-dom rules and extended windfall tax on energy firms and new vaping and tobacco levies. I would venture that it didn't really feel like an election-winning budget. So there was no rabbit out of the hat, and they scaled back on some of these kind of more ambitious policies that were speculated about before. So it could well be that we might see another autumn statement later in the year, and that's when the government hopes that the economy will have improved and they can maybe put some of these more exciting measures in place.
Yeah, I think the idea of an election-winning budget, given the polls at the moment, is hard to comprehend what that would be, isn't
that's
it?
That's true.
We've discussed some of these measures last time round and before, including the windfall tax and full expensing. When we look at it in sum, as you say, a relatively muted affair in terms of overall spend as well, I think that's fair to say. How did we get to this position?
Yeah.
Because it's all about the quote-unquote fiscal headroom, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it was very muted. So the measures yesterday add up to about 0.5% of GDP. And if we use Liz Truss's mini budget for context, that was closer to 2%. So this was very, very scaled back. If we look at the measures, it looks like they're going to cost an average of about £10 billion per year, but it will be front-loaded, so it will give us a boost of about £14 billion next year before fading over the next 5 years. It doesn't really look like this is going to be enough to make that much difference to growth, so economists have estimated that it's going to deliver about a 0.1 percentage point boost to growth this year. But given that we are currently in a very mild recession, that tiny boost could actually be quite helpful, and it might be enough to get us out of a recession, which would be better news for the government as they approach an election.
Yeah, it does all seem like tinkering around the edges a bit, doesn't it, when you think of,
yeah,
or when I think of what I perceive to be the big need for capital spending, etc. But the other thing that has been going on, again, quite similar to the autumn statement, is these five-year forecasts, the five-year rules, are being used to kick the can down the road, less so this time, but very much, I think it's been picked up a lot as well, hasn't it, in recent weeks and months, to create a fiction of what will happen after that five-year period so that spending can be brought forward or tax cuts can be brought forward.
I mean, absolutely. So the Chancellor is bound by these fiscal rules, which put limits on debt as a proportion of GDP and government borrowing on a five-year rolling basis. So these were designed to try and kind of bolster the government's fiscal credibility. And the gap between the forecast level of debt and the figure that would break the rule is what we call the headroom. And it sort of tells us how much room for manoeuvre the Chancellor's got. And at the moment, he hasn't got very much at all. So he had just under £9 billion yesterday, compared to £13 billion at the autumn statement, and an average of almost £30 billion that chancellors have had since 2010. The problem with headroom is that it really depends what's happening in 5 years' time. So if you follow the spirit of the rules, they're all about making sure that the government finance position is sustainable and you're not taking a very short-termist view. If you follow them to the letter, you can end up in a slightly weird position where our inflation forecast for 5 years' time can have a huge impact on what we can actually spend today. And the OBR runs some stress tests when it produces forecasts, and they showed this time that a minuscule change in growth or inflation or interest rates can make this headroom double or disappear entirely.
Let's talk about the perspective of the opposition party, because there is an election coming and current polls suggest they won't be in opposition for too much longer. They'll be in charge. And what this budget did do is create some issues for them deliberately. I think insofar as it took some key policies, key revenue raisers, and used them to pay for things like the NI cut. I'm thinking here of the abolition of the non-dom status, the extension of the oil and gas windfall tax. So when we are in a time where governments are looking for revenue, whoever the government is, Labour are now going to have to come up with some other revenue raisers to pay for what they want to do. So that might, you know, raise the question for investors and for people in markets and, you know, looking at all the allowances we have, of which we'll come to some in a moment, of what Labour might be looking at, you know.
I mean, I think that the next government, whoever they are, have been left in a really difficult position. So Hunt's sums only add up if we assume that you're going to get rid of the fuel duty freeze, which no government has done since 2011, and that there's going to be a pretty implausible squeeze on public spending. So for Hunt to have this headroom, he's going to have to increase real spending by 1% per year, which sounds okay, but once you take into account that lots of areas like the NHS and defence and education are protected, that actually means a 2.3% real-term spending cut in other departments. And I saw some figures this morning that said that preventing this would require £13 billion worth of tax rises. So that's the kind of fiscal environment that the next government is going to inherit, which is very, very difficult. I also think that whoever wins the next election will face a more hostile market environment too. So I think we were sort of in a bit of a grace period with this spring budget, where everyone knows that governments tend to cut taxes before an election and put them up again. So in a way, whatever was announced today probably didn't have much to say about the long-term outlook for the UK economy. And this will definitely change. So the first budget after the next election is going to face much more scrutiny, and we could see a much bigger market reaction based on what it suggests about growth or how fiscally prudent the new government is going to be.
Well, some of the, from an investment point of view, some of the allowances have been cut fairly close to the bone already, thinking of the dividend allowance and the capital gains tax allowance, which are falling again in the new tax year from April. However, there is a new tax-free investment allowance in the shape of the UK ISA, or there may well be, we should say, because it's currently in a consultation for 3 months and then it's got to get off the ground, and then one might assume that election matters may take over. But can we talk a bit about what this is to begin with, and then I'll bring in the rest of the team as well, because it has divided opinion a little bit.
Yeah, so this new British ISA, which is still in consultation, it would give investors a dedicated ISA allowance of £5,000 to invest in UK shares. And crucially, this would come on top of the existing £20,000 allowance. From an economics perspective, it's pretty light. So the OBR hasn't costed anything yet because it's still in consultation. But it could have the advantage, I suppose, if it boosts British companies, could help to generate higher tax revenues. And I suppose it's also very cheap.
Yes, the idea, I think, very much is about boosting the UK market, isn't it? We've discussed that on this show before. The companies that are not listing, the companies that are being taken over, the government's been looking at this. It seems to me a lot of the supply side reforms, structural reforms, will take a long time. And this is one potential demand side move that is relatively cheap, certainly. Whether it's quick and easy is a different question, because there is the question of what goes in this ISA. You can have UK shares. It looks like you'll be able to have funds and investment trusts. Then the question which the consultation poses is, what kind of funds and trusts can you use? They refer back to the old PEPS rule, where you had to have 75% of assets in the UK. I know our funds editor, Dave Baxter, was looking yesterday at some funds which are around that level and what happens if they dip over or under, or how you do these things. The other question, I think, for people is, A, is this really going to have any impact on companies at all? And we did see a little movement in the FTSE 250 yesterday in response to this specific announcement. But also B, is it just adding complexity? Is it going to confuse people? Is it needed? Should they have just raised the ISA allowance in general? I don't know. It's definitely divided opinion in many places. I know our editor is very much in favour of it. Others maybe on the team less so. Julian, Mark, what about you? What are your thoughts on the UK ISA? A good idea, worth a try, or...
It's an interesting one. I was speaking to someone this morning, actually. I think it was Brooks McDonald. They were telling me that they reckon, from their analysis, that this is only going to allow about £4 billion of funds to go into UK equities, somewhere around that mark, because you know, there's roughly 800,000 people with an allowance that they could possibly put into it. So it's I don't know, it's not going to move a huge amount, I don't think, in terms of getting people buying UK equities specifically. I would say it's a non-starter. But then, you know, I will toe the editorial line, of course.
There's no room for a diversity of opinion.
Well, I think the initial part of it anyway, I mean, it's going to appeal to some people just because anyone who's like maxed out their ISA limit on the other four types of ISAs available out there at the moment. So you're going to get a sort of influx on that basis. It might have a snowball effect as well if it works particularly well. There was a critique in one of the broadsheets this morning that was suggesting that you'll end up losing money relative over the long run because of the relative performance of UK equities. But that's a bit of a self-defeating argument, if you ask me, because surely this is just one of the measures designed to stimulate that secondary market a little bit more. So it's certainly worth a try. And like Julian as well, I'm going to fall into line with the messages from above.
Mm. I also do think, and I promise you this is my opinion, not a mandated one. I do think it's worth a try. It may be tinkering around the edges, but sometimes sentiment and momentum in these things is important. And ultimately, I think for the small group of people who do already max out their ISA allocations, this is an extra £5,000 on top. That does mean that you will have to have at least 20% of your ISA in UK shares. But as home biases go, I don't think that's unusual from a global perspective. You do also have similar examples in Europe. Lots of other countries do have similar schemes still, as we used to have with the PEP. And I think it's fair enough to say if you want an extra £5,000 tax-free, this is what you have to invest in. It's quite similar in some ways to saying if you want IHT relief, you have to invest in AIM shares, things like that. It's not unusual or beyond the pale to make those kind of stipulations, and if you want to reshape your portfolio that way to get the tax benefits, then so be it. I don't know. It may not actually happen, though, as we say, because there is this consultation. There is some opposition to it.
They've got to work out as well what actually qualifies as a UK investment within the British ISA.
Yeah.
I mean, it's part of the consultation.
I think that is why some people are sceptical too, certainly some platforms, because of the complexity in administering it as much as anything else. AJ Bell were quite against it, albeit it was quite amusing that their shares went up a couple of percent yesterday.
Yes.
Their investors clearly think it'll be good for them, but they don't want it.
I think the CEO, Michael Summerskill, it was interesting because he called it the proposal a laudable one, but I think his views are quite strongly held that he thinks it is ill-conceived and it's a politically motivated product that it won't achieve the objective that it is trying to go for. I mean, his proposal, I thought was quite interesting, that he says the ISA system just needs simplifying. If you want to unleash this untapped share culture in the UK and you want more people to start, think about the stock market, buying UK companies, buying whatever kind of assets that are going to improve their long-term wealth prospects, the way to do that is just to remove the complexity. And, this is just another product in, a sort of a litany of ISAs that his view is are putting people off. And, you would have to defer in a way to the manager of the second largest, brokerage platform in the UK, because their whole job is marketing this stuff and they know the barriers to entry better than anyone. So I was quite, it's unusual for a CEO to be that candid about a political statement, but the points that he was making, obviously seemed to be backed up by some evidence.
Mm. Well, some of the other platforms are in favour, which may simply be a factor that, you know, this may encourage more inflows into their platforms rather than into UK companies specifically. So self-interest there, but there's self-interest everywhere in this situation. That's a natural part of life. I mean, I do wonder as well whether the complexity argument is important. There are too many ISAs. Equally, the stocks and shares ISA wouldn't seem to me to be too hard to understand for people who are in a cash ISA right now. It's more about a risk aversion, I would say, rather than being confused. And there are a lot of people, as we know, you look at the statistics, the amount that is in cash ISAs is huge, isn't it, proportionately. And there is a question about how to get these people to invest for their futures. Whether getting rid of ISAs and making things simpler is an answer to that, I don't know. But it is a fair point that there are too many ISAs, and this just adds another one, because it will have to stay separate because the rules mean you can't merge it with a stocks and shares ISA, because it'll be even more impossible to administer. We will see. We should probably move on, though. Although I feel we could talk about this all day. Let's look now at, as I say, one of the most popular UK shares, Legal & General, had figures out this week, Julian. How do they strike you?
It's a surprisingly muted reaction to the shares to the announcement, to be honest, Dan, which in some ways is difficult to unpack. But Legal & General basically is doing very well. So they've sewn up more or less the UK pension transfer market. But more than half of their operating profit comes from that segment alone, which was the strategic vision of their now departed CEO, Nigel Wilson. I suspect that the market was expecting more from Antonio Simoes, who is taking over the hot seat at Legal & General. But he didn't really have much to say about what he's going to do and what direction Legal & General is going to take. But they did say that they would give more detail at Capital Markets Day in June, and they would outline their strategy and how they see things developing. But the problem, I guess, from an investment perspective, is what is the alternative strategy? Because the current one seems to be working very well, really, for the company. And the question really is whether putting so much reliance on the pension transfer market is entirely wise, given we know how, you know, the occasional black swan will come along and throw everything into turmoil, which there are plenty of examples of that in the past. I felt it was a reasonable set of results from on their own terms, but people are nervous of the company, which is, I think, slightly paradoxical. But that whole LDI scandal is in the background somewhere. Although, you know, Legal & General didn't really have anything directly to do with it. They were a sort of broker for hedging products, but there is a nervousness about the company at the moment, and it might take until this Capital Markets Day with a clearer vision articulated to get people to be more enthusiastic about it.
Yeah, the company, you know, that retirement arm operating profit there was around 900 million, so approaching half nowadays of total operating profit. It does have the other arms, which involve, there's the Legal & General Alternatives business, which has some house builder exposure as well. There's the retail arm, and there's the asset management arm. A few of these were a bit light, I think, in terms of consensus forecasts, but there's no doubt that retirement business, the bulk annuity business, as you say, is doing really well still.
Yeah, I mean, they're getting 10% growth rates a year at the moment, and no other part of the business is achieving that. Legal is a benchmark share. We just have to, take. But it's not one that changes its core proposition very quickly. So, the idea that they're suddenly going to come up with a massive new strategy that's going to make the rest of the business perform wonderfully well is fanciful, I think, in my view. But they have promised more detail on what they're going to do about it. So, I guess it's a question of just waiting on your hands and just taking the massive 9% dividend yield, really.
Well, exactly. In the meantime, you're being paid pretty well to wait, aren't you? And that dividend looks pretty secure. The Solvency II ratio, pretty good as well, ahead of forecast there. So in terms of the safety of that payout, despite it being, you know, near double-digit levels, which typically is a level you'd think is at risk of being cut, that seems like it's looking okay for now.
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, I don't think there's any concern about how they're going to spend every year. It's just, it is in a transition phase, and it feels transitional that, the new management needs to bed in, and they do have work to do. I think there's no question about it. They can't rely on one division providing so much of the operating profit. Because that is as we all know from experience, operational gearing in that respect can go the other way very pretty quickly.
The market is still treating the company, notwithstanding the strength of the retirement arm, as very interest rate sensitive, isn't it? You look at the share price performance, and it really went down last year as rates went up, and then rallied on the back of the softening of interest rate expectations we saw at the end of last year. Clearly, there is. It has the small house builder business, it has the asset management arm, both of which are sensitive to interest rates. And there's general investment exposures, I think we've spoken about on this show before, where people are concerned maybe about what may lie in their investment book.
They've got corporate loans as well out in the in the market, their own office buildings in, Bracknell or wherever there are lots of office buildings. Yes, it does feel, it is a strange, in many ways, a strange share. And it's behaving, as you say, it is behaving in a way that in some ways management can't really do anything about, which is, you can't tell the Bank of England to, keep interest rates at a certain level because that will benefit your business. And but I'm not sure whether that's entirely merited, and I'm also not sure whether there isn't just a level of hesitancy about what is lurking in the balance sheet that people don't know or don't understand. So that's why you're getting this very high risk premium, effectively.
The question, clearly, retail has been buying a lot. You look at the platforms, and Legal & General is always one of the most bought shares nowadays because I suspect of that big dividend yield. The question maybe is whether the institutional buyers then are quite so keen, and whether they are, looking elsewhere. Insurers have been doing a bit better recently.
Yeah, they're generally underweight. Yeah, the problem they have is that with the big portfolio managers, they're generally underweight insurance. It's only the sort of value strategies that tend to pick them up. Or if you're running a dividend fund, it's the ideal dividend share to hold. Yes, I mean, as you say, it's a retail star, and whether that's translating into popularity in the rest of the market is open to debate, really. But we just have to wait till June and see what they say. They're going to identify the issues, and whether they take it from there and trigger a new share price run, really.
I've been looking at the forward rating as well, and it's pretty in line with peers within the industry as well. But I guess the interesting figure is that it does look slightly expensive when you factor in projected growth rates too, and likely return on equity. And I guess that's part of the reason why it's reflected in the share price, obviously. But if you've got an implied dividend yield of 9% and a forward PE rating of 9.5, I mean, as you mentioned before, Dan, as well, a really impressive solvency rating too. So, I mean, risk reward, I think I can understand why people are adding it to their portfolios.
Well, on the subject of dividends, that brings us neatly to our cover feature this week, which is all about why they matter. Alex, you wrote this, and very much in the context of, perhaps changing attitudes to dividends now, but B, in the context of, say, the US market, where for years they were certainly viewed as not the done thing, to say the least. Obviously, over here, they're a big part of investing. Over there, at least stereotypically, it's much more about going for growth, and why would you be paying a dividend rather than investing in the business? Can you say a bit more about sort of that context, and also what you were trying to explore with the piece?
Sure. So LNG, very good example of the sort of company that is not only liked by retail investors, but coverage of their news flow does very well on our website, and we know from feedback from readers and listeners that dividends are, you know, clearly very important to them. I mean, that makes intuitive sense because they're, you know, they're not only, as you point out, a big feature of the UK equity market, but because they fund readers and investors' lives, you know, and they're a big reason for owning the shares. You know, I think although buybacks are increasingly a thing in UK markets, you wouldn't conclude that dividends are out of favour here per se. But because of the weight of US stocks in global equity portfolios and the growth of some US companies, you know, we're perennially drawn to America, what's happening there. And I suppose for a while there's been this view, I suppose shared by former colleagues, I've been sympathetic to in the past as well, and it's a view that's kind of originated in US financial academia, that dividends are a bit of an anachronism. You know, if you think about it, a dividend is just going from a corporate bank account, the contents of which you already part own, and into your brokerage account. So the theory against dividends, in a sense, is kind of sound. There's, you know, it's a transfer in and of itself cannot create value. And the alternative, the total return strategy to investing in shares, if you need income, just sell the equivalent stake, you know, whatever it is, 4 or 5% in the market, and let the rest of your holding do the capital gains appreciation. But I suppose the other bit of context you alluded to there, in recent decades, you know, certain sectors like biotech, technology, software, and the investing mantra has really focused on growth. So if some interpret the modern price of investing as landing, I suppose, 10 or 100 bagger stocks, which since the dot-com boom has been a recurring feature of markets, then, you know, dividends seem a little bit quaint, really. You're never going to sort of 10 times your capital in a few years by focusing on, you know, sensible dividend cover and how that balances out. And many of America's most successful companies don't pay a dividend. So that, and I suppose, you know, some of the larger stock market debuts we've seen here in recent years, such as THG, Deliveroo and Oxford Nanopore, all dividendless companies. I suppose the background was to try and understand what's happened a little bit and, you know, ultimately concluded or wanted to make the case for why dividends matter despite the direction that we seem to have been heading in.
The other context for this, as we talk about, is the idea that the UK market is slovenly and ex-growth in many cases. But dividends matter, not least because maybe they instill an element of discipline in a company, is one thing you could say. But also you look at it closely from the perspective of not just capital allocation, but how investors themselves can crystallize the worth of their shares, and the flexibility this provides them with as well is something which is sometimes overlooked, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I think we can almost put aside the comparisons of, you know, what does the, you know, we talk about it a lot, but what does the FTSE 100 look like? What are its businesses looking like? Where is there, you know, where are the opportunities elsewhere and how everything compares? The argument, I think, really boils down to the very basics of investing in stocks. So what is a share of a business without the possibility of participating in its cash flows? Where do stock returns come from? In the UK market, is historically been from dividends. I mean, there's actually over, if you look back, I think the Barclays Gilt study looks back to 1945. The amount that's come from capital gains is rather small, actually. And so dividends either reinvested or taken at source have been a real, real wealth generator. And then, yeah, the point you mentioned there or allude to, you know, what happens if market prices are disconnected from reality, or, you know, there's a massive temporary setback just at the moment when an investor needs the cash? Do you then take a bigger chunk at a big markdown to your holding? These are all quite thorny issues that come up when you just rely on the total return strategy of just selling down a bit of your holding annually or whenever it might be. So, you know, in short, I think, yeah, I mean, dividends kind of allow investors to ignore the constant noise of price volatility. And to the discipline point, it allows them to focus on, you know, the relationship between a company's opportunities and its owners. And I think that cuts both ways. You know, it's a way for the managers of a company to think about dividends in the context of all the other things they could use capital for: deleveraging, salaries, M&A, whatever it is. And that actually, this sounds like a circular argument, but the dividends matter merely by being considered as an option, because you know that makes executives or managers of businesses think about all the options and also the relationship they have with investors. So you know, it's maybe a bit of an old-fashioned argument, but I think it is one that is worth making.
Well, coming back into fashion in some ways, maybe. There's a new book written on the subject, the author of which you've interviewed for a recent IC Interviews podcast. And then at a company level, of course, again, sorry to go back to the US example, but the likes of Meta now paying a dividend have raised some eyebrows and maybe raised some interest as well in those very arguments you were just making.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, if this listeners sort of really want an in-depth take on the book, which, you know, did inspire the piece to a large extent, then definitely listen to that interview with Dan Peris or buy the book, which you know I think is brilliant really. But his view, I suppose, in a more US specific context, is that you know you've got this academic grip on the dividend narrative, and that's also coincided with globalization, falling risk rates, financial engineering, and a bit of a disconnect in corporate governance terms between business managers and their owners, and that essentially US equity markets have lost or are losing sight of the purpose of share ownership, which is Dan Peris's argument, I think there's some weight to it, is to participate in a meaningful income stream. I think as an investor, and he does manage funds as well, he's not arguing that companies sort of suddenly abandon value accretive capital projects in favour of just, you know, shelling out as much money as they can to investors. His argument is that companies re-establish dividends as a business outcome in itself. So, I think he talks about lots of other things as well. And I would urge people to either buy the book or see what else you can find that he's said on the topic.
Mm. Another interesting point you make in the piece is when these academic theories were first around, the levels of corporate profitability were quite a bit lower than they are today. So the argument that a dividend means there are no good levels or there are no good options for internal reinvestment out there is maybe no longer quite so true, because you could perhaps do both. You could have your cake and eat it. Equally, to flip that argument round, there might be some noises from Warren Buffett. You identify in the piece maybe as well, when he's talking right now about struggling to find any investment opportunities, that maybe he may be converted to the dividend way as well.
I mean, I suppose if we talk about Warren Buffett there, then you know, as ever, we probably need to be careful when we're talking about Buffett, you know, given the risks of generalizing what is clearly an exceptional case study of an investor with probably an unrepeatable track record. But yeah, caveat out of the way, he's probably guilty of inconsistency, I think, when it comes to dividends. So, you know, on the one hand, he absolutely loves receiving them. They've undoubtedly led to a considerable compounding effect in the Berkshire Hathaway equity portfolio. And, you know, it's provided an extra cash float to his reinvestment and growing that into an enormous business. I don't think he invests in companies. I might be wrong. I don't think he invests in companies or doesn't have large stakes in companies that don't pay a dividend. So, he is a fan. On the other hand, Berkshire Hathaway doesn't pay a dividend, and its A-class shares are now, you know, something, I think they cost something like $600,000 a pop. So if you want voting rights and an income and to be a Berkshire Hathaway business owner, you'll have to convert your A shares into, you know, kind of a nice position to be in if you find yourself in this position, but you'll have to convert the A shares into 1500 share blocks of B shares and then sell them in the market if you want any income. So Warren Buffett defends this by saying that, you know, they'll pay a dividend when they've exhausted their options for returns, which is, those are kind of the noises he's making at the moment. So I wouldn't rule out a dividend in future years, but you know, this is a different game. This is Warren Buffett. People are prepared to put, you know, their faith in him for eternity. So he has kind of the space to, you know, be slightly hypocritical when it comes to this particular element of corporate governance.
Mm. Just thinking out loud, I suppose that's the definition of this show, really. but I wonder if, you know, Buffett, when he eventually retires or moves on, whether then that will be the moment they decide to pay a dividend. You know, the pressure will be on the successor to make some fabulous investments. They might take a path of less resistance, perhaps, and pay some out.
Maybe. And, you know, it was hard to unpack. You mentioned Meta before. It's hard to unpack their announcement. They were going to pay a very, very small dividend from their enormous share price reaction, because they had lots of other good news in that fourth quarter report. But it does suggest, maybe, if you're in the camp that thinks that the dividend was part of the positive reception, that actually re-establishing that income link in the shares is a reason, you know, if not for celebration, then maybe a slightly higher valuation. You don't know. So, yeah, I don't want to speculate what happens after Buffett, because there's so many moving parts there. But yeah, that's one outcome potentially. Or the company culture will change, or it will adhere to his standards for the next century.
Mm. You know what? I think this argument keeps on coming up in the UK as well. I mean, there's always people looking to see if there's a correlation between high levels of R&D and companies or markets that pay low levels of dividends. You could probably find some correlations in that regard. But to Dan's earlier point as well, profitability and cash flows in many cases now are so large. If you don't have a pressure valve of a dividend, you could end up with misallocation of capital because management feel if they've got huge amounts of capital around, they've got to do something with it. And this could lead to sort of intemperate investment decisions too. So I think it's kind of a philosophical debate over here, because the UK has always had a pretty good record in terms of returning surplus capital, whatever that means, back to shareholders. I mean, if I was the owner of a company, I always like to think that I would have a better idea of what to do with my surplus capital than management.
Indeed.
And of course, you can always reinvest the dividends as well.
Well, exactly. As I say, that is our cover story this week. To tie things together nicely, of course, dividends and dividend-paying companies would be very appropriate for an ISA, because there'd be no dividend tax to pay. So that brings us back to the UK ISA and reminds me that next week is our ISA special issue, so look out for that as well. For today, however, we are going to finish with a brief look at Spirent Communications. Last week, we had a little discussion about M&A activity in the UK market and bidding wars. Mark, there hasn't been a bidding war in this case, because a US peer has come in way over the top with a big, I think, 60% premium to the previous closing day share price for Spirent. What did you make of that? And also, maybe we should put it in the context of the difficult time the company's had in recent months.
Yeah, it was a pretty hefty premium to the closing price on the previous or the last trading day there. But it has to be seen in context. Obviously, the shares have been on a bit of a roller coaster ride over the last 6 months or so. Mm. The firm, Viavi, very similar in a way to Spirent. It's a NASDAQ-listed company, again, involved in testing of telecoms equipment and network. So you can see there's quite a good, well, you imagine there's quite a good strategic fit there. The bid itself includes a special dividend payment of 2.5p, a share, and so you see there's bound to be a significant overlap between the two businesses, and from that perspective it does make sense. But I was, after looking at it, I was wondering if this has sort of come in at a moment of weakness for the company, and it's been backed by management, and I did take the precaution of checking if there'd been any director dealing in the lead up to the deal. They hadn't, apart from a few matching share obligations. But I did note that after the Q3 profits warning and trading update as well, a couple of the principals came in and made some fairly hefty acquisition of the shares. I mean, that's probably to be expected, because that's what normally happens whenever you get a profit warning. Management like to sort of reiterate their confidence in the business.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough, isn't it? With that profit warning, I think sent the shares down 30% from memory back in the autumn, and you would certainly hope management would be buying at that stage. Nonetheless, as you say, that context is important, because I think the shares are still down on a 1-year view despite this bid, because that profit warning was particularly bad. And it was, I mean, this deal has been framed in the context, as all deals are nowadays, of another UK share being removed from the market, a US big firm coming in. You know, this is a tech adjacent sector, or a tech sector, if you want to call it that. And the UK doesn't do that very well. But that profit warning itself was quite worrying, I think, because it came very quickly after a trading update, which wasn't quite so alarming last summer. And I think some analysts were quite skeptical of how management had communicated the progress of the business last year. So in some ways, this deal bails them out a little bit.
Yeah, certainly. But I mean, to be fair to the company, at the time of the half year, they did note that the order intake had dropped by about a fifth. So going on, and this was against some other relatively positive metrics that came out at the same time. So I don't know if the company was willfully misleading the market on that one as well. I part of the reason, I mean, they've got a relatively large exposure to the Chinese market as well, which is a little bit unusual for companies, or not unusual, but the scale of their exposure is unusual compared to other players in the telecom market as well. And I think, obviously, that the recovery in the mainland China market has been fairly anemic in relation to expectations, which may go some way towards explaining why they had that sort of pretty dire Q3 update. The question is, you know, I guess from an investment perspective, I mean, was that interim update, was it prudential? I mean, surely by then they'd have had some idea of actually how the Chinese demand was playing out. You know, this drama around with the results as well. I mean, there was the sort of profitability created, albeit against an increase in the gross margin as well, which I found kind of interesting, really. You know, there's still been some operational progress over the last few months as well. And they managed to secure new 5G-related contracts as well from over about 150 companies. And the order book is, you know, it's dipped, obviously, but it still stands at just under $500 million dollars. So I don't know, is this an opportunistic sort of offer from the US? It's hard to say. I guess on that point you made before, if we were seeing a few more IPOs, it's unlikely that we'd have, this would have come under focus, really. But there we have it.
Yeah, the lack of companies coming onto the market is in some ways the bigger problem than companies being bought, isn't it? Because the latter will always happen. But you do need the former as well. Alex, just to conclude, what are your thoughts?
It's a tricky one. So we wrote about them a few times last year in the context of, I suppose, the kind of looking at the bull case for the shares. And I think it did hinge on the idea that now they're into 5G, the 5G market, they were going to move from this very cyclical telecom suppliers capital spending issues, which had meant that in a recession or whenever there was difficulty, contracts were pulled and then they would all suddenly rush in at once. And the idea that because 5G was so complicated that the services component would always be on and they would always have this very constant demand and it would smooth things out. And clearly that's not happened. There's still been a large degree of cyclicality there. So I think that maybe complicates the argument that, oh, there's sort of trapped value here that is not being reflected in the takeout price. I mean, it's clearly opportunistic by VRV to come in. You know, they've had a rough time as well. They're adding a competitor at a moment of weakness. I suppose that's, you know, that's what you're meant to do, aren't you? When industries are consolidating at the bottom, if they are able to get the financing, which they've been able to do, it looks like they're going to be able to do, and build there and come back stronger. So, yeah, I suppose that complicates the idea that this was a company that should be on a much, much higher rating and that investors should have looked through the recent setback, because clearly the new brave 5G world, Spirent Communications, wasn't quite as strong as anticipated. So a tough one here. It's interesting to see Keith Ashworth Lord at the Buffetology Fund you know, said, look, they're a holder and they're minded not to accept the bid at the level, hoping for a counter bidder to arrive. So it might not be a done deal yet, but yeah, you can understand the frustrations of some shareholders at the experience of the last year.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, we have unfortunately run out of time, but thank you very much to everyone for taking part. Thank you to Alex. Thank you to Hermione, to Julian, to Mark, to our producer, Maddie Apthorpe. And thank you to all of our listeners as well. We'll be back next week with another Companies and Markets show.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.